Today, I'm going to talk a bit about DATEX L, the German CSPDN. CSPDN means Circuit Switched Public Data Network. It's a type of public network that was provided in addition to telephony networks some decades ago. This talk is part of the Retro NetCall series, which is a series of talks about retro networking topics that we spun off the Osmo Dev Call, the Osmocom developer call, which is about open source mobile communications projects. A disclaimer before we go into the actual topic. I never used DATEX L when it existed, so this is all just based on reading historical books, articles, specifications, whatnot. And of course, my understanding might be incorrect. So if anyone has better knowledge or more expertise, or please correct me. I'm very happy to learn more about old technology. And if you have any questions that can be part of the record, feel free to raise them at any time. Just write in the chat or raise your hand or something like that. Apart from that, we can do it after. If you don't want it on the record, we do it after the recording has finished. So yeah, what is a CSPDN, a Circuit Switched Public Data Network? So basically, the name leads us to two different terms that have a well-known understanding. The first is circuit switched. So it is about dedicated circuits which are established and released, just like in the telephone network. We make a call, then the call is established, and we have an end-to-end dedicated resource, the voice call or the call in the telephony network, or the data call in the CSPDN network, it can be released by either sides at a later point. So this is quite different from packet switch networks such as IP networks, or also the DATEX P network in Germany, which is not what I'm talking about today. So it's about circuit switch technology. And it's a public data network, meaning it is, well, it's a public network and it transports data. So it's available to the general public, like the telephony network, but it's used for data, not speech, unlike the telephony network. And those circuit switch packet data networks were separate networks, independent of the telephony networks. So we're not talking about using some modems on top of telephony networks, but we're talking about a complete and entirely separate network that existed in parallel to the telephone network and in parallel to possibly other networks. So for example, in the early days, it existed in parallel to the Telex network, meaning teletype kind of devices. And it also existed at the end in parallel to, for example, the ISDN network, which was again an independent network. So independent means we have separate infrastructure, separate switches, the only part that may or may not be reused is, of course, some of the cables that already existed, either in the backbone or in the subscriber line, but separate switches. So even if the same cable could be physically routed to a telephony switch or to a CSPDN switch, that was something you did once, and then it was used and permanently attached for years or decades to one type of network. So it's not, there's no connection between those networks. It's just that cables can be used either this way or the other way. So what did we have before those CSPDNs came around? And we will look a bit at the history and the timeline briefly. I see some embarrassing copy and paste mistake in that slide. Sorry for that. So, of course, there was the public switch telephone network, the PSTN, that is not for 50 bits per second. It's an analog network. There's no bits per second. It's an analog network. It was initially manually switched and later electromechanically switched, meaning that connections are made at central offices or exchanges. And in the telephony network, it's an analog circuit. So there's no digital part of it in the classic PSTN, meaning that analog signals up to 3.4 kilohertz could pass it. End-to-end analog connection with possibly amplifiers and modulators, demodulators, whatever in between, but it's an analog end-to-end circuit. Then we had the public switch telex network, which was for telex or Fernschreiben in German. Those networks were also analog, but all the devices connected to it were digital devices, basically telex devices, so teletypes, which used a fixed speed of 50 bit per second. It was asynchronous start-stop transmission. So there's no central clock, nothing. There's a start bit, I think a 5-bit data field and a stop bit, and that is asynchronous transmission mode. And it also was an analog network end-to-end, meaning that the switches really just created electrical connections, and those bits were transmitted from one end to the other over the analog circuit in between. That switching, like in the telephony network, was initially manually and then later moved over to electromechanical. For a long time, of course, it was mixed mode. So some exchanges were using electromechanical automatic switching, and some connections or some exchanges still analog. I know in Germany, for example, I think the international connections in Telex were manually switched for quite some time, even after the national Telex network was already fully automatic switching. What you could also have already before CSPDNs were around as direct point-to-point links. That means it's a permanent circuit, a permanent connection between two subscribers on the two sides of the link. There's no switching involved. Those are hardwired and set up once, and then they run for months, years, decades. So no switching and no dialing and no connections that are established or released. It's always on, and it's permanent. In German, there are two terms that show up in the literature and in the documents and also sometimes in this presentation. One of them is HFD or HFD, if you pronounce the acronym in English. The German name is Hauptanschluss für Direktruf, which is basically not just the leased copper line, but you also get the modem or the data communications equipment from the operator. So the interface to the user is basically some kind of serial interface. There's different flavors of this. And the operator provides you the service of transporting these serial data bits that you send over the serial interface via some network somewhere, and it appears at another end, but on both sides the interface towards the network is a serial interface, it is basically not the concern of the subscriber whether or not modems are used or what kind of transmission technology is used or what modulation forms or whatever. That's all an internal implementation detail of the network, that was I think rather predominant before the CSPDN came around. The other option was called Überlassung posteigener Stromwege. If you translate that to English, it's something like leasing of post property circuits. So in that case, you really only rented the bare copper wires and you attached your own communication equipment to that. Some terminology that will show up in this talk, or at least in the first half or so of it. So we have DBP. If that DBP shows up, it's Deutsche Bundespost, which is the German postal services operator, government-owned monopoly until the 1990s. CSPDNs, I already mentioned it several times. It's the general abstract concept of such public circuit switch data networks, which was defined in the CCITT, how it was called still back then, or now the ITUT, so an international organization of the various government postal administrations. And then the CSPDN technology was implemented in various different countries, or rather was implemented by vendors of equipment. And then this equipment implementing the CSPDN principle was used to create networks. And one such network in Germany was the DATEX-L network. DATEX means data exchange. So even though it's a German acronym from the 1960s, it already used English terminology. And the L is for Leitungsorientiert, which means circuit-oriented. This is the topic of this talk. There was also DATEX-P, Paket-Orientiert, the packet-switched public data network, which is off-topic here. I'm sure we will have a talk about this at some other incarnation of the RetroNet call. Another topic that shows up in this talk is IDN, the Integriertes Text- und Datennetz, Integrated Text and Data Network. That was the German network that was created initially it was inaugurated in 1975, and it was used to provide services such as Telex or Gentex, which was the internal network of the postal services to transmit telegrams electronically between different post offices in Germany, and also the DATEX services, so DATEX services. So IDN basically is an underlying network technology that was used to provide DATEX-L service. And the system, the hardware and software that was used to create this IDN network is called EDS. EDS is for Elektronisches Datenvermittlungssystem, Electronic Data Exchange System. And that is the switching technology developed by Siemens and Standard Electronic Lorenz, two German manufacturers. They provided the actual hardware and software running on the hardware to create the IDN, which was used to provide the DATEX service. So just to get an overview, these are the kind of services that you could get in 1980. As I said, well, we will look at DATEX again and the timeline in another slide, but this was just a diagram that I could find from 1980 when all these different technologies coexisted. So we have digital data and text network here, which that's basically the IDN here, this box, and you have dialed connections and permanent connections. And the dialed connections could offer Telex service, so this teletype service, the DATEX network, which we will be talking about today, also the Gentex, the internal network for transmission of telegrams. And you could also get leased lines. As I said, these are the two things I already mentioned. So we had here these HFD connections with the modem or data communications equipment provided, and then also the option to get leased lines basically without any equipment. And then, yeah, we have, of course, the telephony network and other transmission lines that existed in the service back then. So why would you create a completely separate data network independent of the telephone network that already existed, or independent of the Telex network that already existed? The problem is, and we are going back to basically 1960s here, is that it was rather technologically difficult to transmit digital data over hundreds or even thousands of kilometers of analog telephone lines. Some modems were already developed in those days, but they were very slow. So we're talking about something like up to 300 bits per second. And they're very expensive because this is before the integrated circuits and the like large scale integration came around. So it was rather complex circuitry, rather expensive. Challenging in those days to communicate data over the telephone network. So slow and expensive, those modems for the normal analog telephony network. And also you had a very long connection establishment time. Keep in mind that at the day of electromechanical switches in Germany, we had pulse dialing only. So setting up a connection, we are talking about, certainly in the tens of seconds until the connection is established. That's relatively long. If, let's say, you want to infrequently exchange a bit of data, for example, from an automatic teller machine, a cash dispenser, or from some other network device, some terminal somewhere that occasionally needs some data. And the idea of the CSPDN is basically that you create a digital network, you only have analog circuits from hop to hop. So this is a diagram that shows describes the IDN in a leased line configuration. So there's no automatic switching in the middle, but basically we have a DEE, that's the data terminal equipment. Then we have a DHE, that's the data communications equipment here at the subscriber. And then we have here that the black line is the subscriber line going to wherever the switch is located here, the first one. And only over that link, which is basically just a few kilometers until the next switch, over that link, you could use baseband transmission, so you didn't have to do modulation, meaning that the cost of this transmission, DCE, or here's the DAG, a Datenanschlussgerät, is the German word in this context, is much lower because you don't need modulation and demodulation, but you just need to do some coding and then you transmit the signal in coding to avoid DC components. So you'd use some kind of coding scheme that avoids any DC parts in your transmitted signal, and you have an AC waveform in baseband that you communicate over the subscriber line. And at the other end, you have the peer, the UE, the Übertragungseinrichtung, I think is the name for it, Übertragungseinheit, which has the same basically in reverse, and it recovers the digital signal, and then you go into the next hop of your communication using the recovered digital signal. You again drive some kind of coding here in a time domain multiplex, ZD, Zeit domain in multiplex, and you go some other hops. But the point is that at each intermediate step, you fully recover the digital signal, so you don't have to cover hundreds of kilometers over various different technologies in analog, but you really have digital regeneration of the signal at every hop. And that makes the end user equipment much less expensive and much less complex. And that's, I think, the fundamental idea behind these CSPDNs. As a distinguishing feature and an advantage technically over doing telephony network-based data transmission. So if we look at the network architecture of the network in a very simple example here, then we have the DTE, the terminal equipment, so some kind of really, a paper-based terminal with a printer or a glass terminal or some kind of mini computer or whatever that existed at the time. It connects over a serial interface. We will look at the different serial interface variants used. Connects to the data communications equipment. It attaches to the subscriber line, and it connects to something called a DUST, Datenumsetzerstelle. That's a multiplexer. That multiplexes multiple low bitrate signals. Low bitrate means 50 to 9600 BPS into 64K multiplexed time division multiplexed signals. And those 64 kilobit links then connect to the actual DVST, Datenvermittlungsstelle, which is the actual switch. And then the switches are interconnected over PCM30 multiplexers. So that is pulse code modulation at 2 megabits with 64 kilobit slots in between. And then at the target destination or the destination switch, it again gets broken out to some kind of multiplexer over the 64K slot, which then breaks it out again to the 50 to 9600 BPS signal that originally entered the network here. That goes again to the data communication equipment on the customer side over the serial interface into the terminal at the other end. So there could be, for example, some kind of mainframe computer at this end and a terminal, like a serial terminal at the other end. So you could have remote attached serial terminals to mainframes over this network. I mentioned before that the, like in a telephony network with electromechanical switching, the call setup takes quite a long time. Here in this system, and DARTEX L with this technology was deployed in 1975. So in 1975 already they had call setup times below 500 milliseconds. So if you would establish a channel from here to any other subscriber in Germany, assuming that the subscriber is not busy, of course, so the line is free at the other end, in less than half a second you have the connection fully set up, and you can exchange data with the user bitrate of 50 to 9600 BPS in a transparent way with the peer. So for the time, I think it's quite an achievement, not just the setup, but to build this in general. We will see this a bit more when we look at the hardware that they used. It's quite a comprehensive technology for that time. So how did it look like geographically? Keep in mind, this is a map of Germany, and of course, Eastern Germany and Western Germany were still separated in these days. So again, to put this into the context of time, the idea to create this network started around 1965. The actual deployment happened in 1975, and it was shut down in 1996 after basically all the services had migrated over to ISDN. So it was rather short-lived, but a bit ahead of its time in many ways. But then as ISDN and came around, and ISDN came at a time where a large-scale integration and development of integrated circuits was already very common. It was very old suddenly, this technology. So we had 18 DVSD, Datenvermittlungsstellen, data switches all across Western Germany and West Berlin, of course. And then each of those had a co-located DUSTD, that's a Datenumsetzerstelle by der Datenvermittlungsstelle, I think is the expanded acronym is on the next slide. And about 400, the full capacity of the network was specified at 400 remote multiplexers, which are DUSTU. Those are basically at other locations that were not close to those 18 Datenvermittlungsstelle. You put one of those remote multiplexers, those DUSTU, Datenumsetzerstelle der unteren Netzebene, the German word for that, to aggregate subscriber lines close to the subscriber. So this is the terminology here. Yeah, so we have Datenvermittlungsstelle, DVST, the data switch. We have the DUST, Datenumsetzerstelle, the multiplexers, and there two, the one at am Standort der Datenvermittlungsstelle, which is co-located with the switch. And then we had the remote ones called der untere Netzebene, of, well, the lower order network or something like that, if you want to translate it. The terminal that the user uses is in German, it's called DEE, which is the Datenendeinrichtung, the English acronym that you know if you've looked at serial protocols and specs like RS-232 before. It's called DTE, Data Terminal Equipment. Then we have the DUE, Datenübertragungseinrichtung. That's the Data Communications Equipment. Most people who've worked with analog modems, that's basically your modem. But in this context, it is in most cases not an actual modem because there's nothing modulated, but it's baseband transmission. The peer at the DUST is called an UEB, an Übertragungseinheit, which is the line transmission interface that talks to the DEE at the DUST side. And then the Siemens product name for this was Datenfernschaltgerät, DFG. So that's the Siemens implementation of a DUE, the Datenübertragungseinrichtung, which is the device at the customer premises that interfaced the terminal with the network. So, which brings us to the interface between the DE and DUE, or the DTE and DCE interface. I already said it's a serial interface, but of course it's not RS-232 because it's actually, I think, older than that. That was the actual interface to the network. So on the telephony network, you think of the interface as the subscriber line, the copper wires. But in this network, the interface is the serial port that comes out of the data communications equipment. DATXL was a synchronous network, meaning that the synchronous interfaces are the native interfaces and they were preferred. There was X.20 at 300 bits per second and X.21 at 2.4, 4.8, and 9.6 kilobits. And the asynchronous interfaces, X20bis and X21bis, which were used to connect equipment that, like data terminal equipment designed for asynchronous communications, to the synchronous network. And the asynchronous interfaces were more expensive because there was additional circuitry needed in the data communications equipment. I found some references that there was actually an additional circuit board that was installed into the data communications equipment to do the async to sync conversion. And then also in the end, you get lower net data throughput as you have those additional start and stop bits and maybe even parity, which need bandwidth. So you reduce your net throughput. And given that the charges are per time, so you pay per second that you're connected, if you reduce your throughput, of course, everything gets more expensive. So what kind of services did we have in this network? These are the services that I could find documented. Allegedly, towards the end, there was also a 48 kilobit service. I couldn't, it's my literature is too old to already list this as a production service. But yeah, so in terms of the introduction, sorry, that's again a typo. This is 1980, not 1970. I should have gone through the slides one more time. So in 1967, the original DATX service, I think it was just called DATX actually, and then later they said it's the DATX L200 when they introduced more services, was asynchronous and 50 to 200 bits per second, and they were still using analog electromechanical switching. And then when they introduced all these additional new services, 300 bits to 9600 bits, this was already on the IDN, the integrated network, with its electronic switching and so on. And this was first introduced in 1976. And then every couple of years, as I said, 1980 here, the last one, sorry for that, higher bit rates were offered as a service. So that's to put this in time. And as I mentioned already, it was provided until 1996. And in 1996, it was decommissioned and switched off. These are pictures of the customer premises equipment, the Datenübertragungseinheit. Here, it's on the left-hand side, it's a DFG-300 for 300 bits per second communication. And on the right-hand side, we have a DFG-2400 for 2,400 bits per second. You can see it's the same design, but some additional layers stacked in the middle in the case, apparently, for additional circuitry for the higher speed processing. So you actually have a dial pad on the device, which you can use to dial. This was in the early days, this was the way how you dialed the destination subscriber. When the X21 interface was introduced with synchronous communication, then also the X21 interface has facilities for the dial information and the signaling to happen at the terminal. So the terminal could basically tell the DFG which destination subscriber to dial. I didn't mention the numbering plan here. I don't have a separate slide for this. Since it was a completely different network, of course, it also had a completely different numbering plan, meaning that the numbers in the DARTEX L network are completely different number ranges and prefixes and subscriber numbers than the telephony network, and there's no interfacing between those two. Similarly, also the telex net for the teletypes already also had its own completely separate numbering plan. So historically, each of those networks has its own numbering plans and subscriber numbers. So this is the slightly later generation for 9,600 bits per second. And here we can see then the split. There was a DFG 9,600 UE1, which still allows you to manually dial here on the dial pad the subscriber that you want to dial. And here the 9,600 UE2 already looks more like a modem as we know it, some desktop brick-sized device, which doesn't have any buttons for dialing numbers, since the actual number to be dialed was conveyed over the X21 interface from the terminal into this device, which then signaled it towards the electronic switch, the Datenvermittlungsstelle. So yeah, we already mentioned that the interface to the subscriber was the serial interface, the X20, X21 interface. But nevertheless, of course, at least for me, it's interesting what did actually happen on the wire, even though it was not the public interface. I already said, depending on the distance, different technologies were used. Predominantly, it was baseband transmission using a pseudo-ternary encoding. Occasionally, when the next Datenumsetzerstelle, the next DUST multiplexer was too far away, so maybe some dozens of kilometers away, I think up to 10 or 20 kilometers, they could do baseband. But if it went beyond that, they actually had to use modems. So they used two-stage differential phase shift keying or four-stage differential phase shift keying in a device called the UEM, the Übertragungseinheit Modem, and UEB is Übertragungseinheit Basisband. In addition, they added a so-called envelope on the wire to the data exchange. The envelope means two additional bits. So every 8-bit of user data were prefixed by two additional bits, the so-called envelope bits. One bit is used for synchronization purpose, since we are a synchronous network. Synchronization is somewhat relevant. And the other bit is used to differentiate the user payload from signaling traffic. Since there's no additional signaling channel, you could just flip this one bit in the 10-bit envelope. And that meant that the 8-bit payload suddenly became not user payload, but became signaling information to be terminated at the data switch, the Datenvermittlungsstelle. This means that the line rate is 25% higher. So let's say you have a 9,600 bit per second service and the 9,600 bit per second Übertragungseinrichtung or the DFG. So basically the device we saw about one or two slides earlier. Yeah, this one, the 9,600 bit per second versions. Then this means the line rate is actually 12,000 bits per second due to this additional 2-bit envelope that gets inserted into the data stream on the line, on the subscriber line. So how much did this cost? We have all the different services here with the different interfaces and the monthly base fee. This is in Deutsche Mark. You have to apply a factor of 1.23 if you want to convert it to euro and compensate for the inflation since 1981 when this I took this from the price sheet. So if you look at this, it's in today's euros and equivalent purchasing power and inflation and so on. Basically, it means 123 euros worth you would have to pay for the 300 bit per second using the synchronous X20 interface. If you needed asynchronous interfaces, you had to pay 20 marks more. At the higher line rates, even 30 marks more. That's, as I said, the asynchronous to synchronous adaptation was something you had to pay extra for. So the synchronous interfaces were lower cost. So you can see a rather substantial monthly fee. But then actually the fees per connection or based on the duration are, I think, rather reasonable if you consider what you could do with them at the time. This is just a sheet from the original documentation, how to compute this. I'm not going to go into this in detail. It's just funny that basically it's specified in fractional Pfennig, where Pfennig is 100th of Deutsche Mark, so kind of cent type. And it's specified per interval of 0.1 seconds. So you have fractional units of the monetary unit and fractional seconds, and then you have to multiply, and then you also have to add an additional fixed fee of 5 Pfennig for each successful connection establishment. So in the normal telephony network, we didn't have that. It was just time-based. So there was no separate fee for establishing the connection in the first place, but here they introduced this. And then there are different multipliers based on the speed. If you translate all of this and you use the inflation corrected conversion into euro, and you then compute how much 1 megabyte of data transmission costs in each of those network technologies, then and then this is in the far distance tariff, so more than 50 kilometers of distance between the two subscribers, you get to these rates. And if you look at, well, of course, the 300 bit per second is not useful for transmitting megabytes of data. That was not what it was intended for. But let's say you get the 9,600 bit per second service and you use it during the night, you could actually transmit 1 megabyte of data for €1.36 all across Germany in 1980. I think that's actually rather reasonable. If you look at you know, how much data 1 megabyte was in the day, and how much, let's say, shipping buying a floppy disk and shipping it in per mail or something like that would have cost you. So I think it actually is rather reasonable during the day. Of course, it's much more expensive, but still, I think based on the time frame in which we put this, I think it's not super expensive. Of course, the monthly rate, you always have to consider that. And of course, there was a one-time setup fee, which was also not cheap. So yeah, as I said, this was like Datex L as a technology was deployed in 1967 with up to 200 bits per second. And then in 1970 and 73, they already established interconnections to France and Belgium between the German network. And then from 1976 onwards, it was this higher bitrate IDN network in Germany, and that then got interconnected to the NPDN, the Nordic Public Data Network, which operated in Denmark, Finland, Norway, and Sweden. I haven't really found much else in terms of international interconnection. I think the circuit switched public data networks were a relatively brief event in history. Since slightly later, that's mostly deployed in the late 60s and 70s. And from 1980, 81 onwards, the packet switched public data networks were around. And those, I think, saw much more users than the circuit switched public data networks. So it was, over relatively soon with this technology. Now, if we look at an actual, like, real-world deployment of such a switch. Now, if we think of a switch today, we think of some Ethernet switch in a rack. If we think of a telephony switch, then we say, oh yes, some rack full of switching equipment. But one of these data switching stations, DVSTs, of which there were 18, as we saw in the map, was actually a rather large floor plan. So that's a floor plan of how this was laid out. And the entire floor plan of what you see here is 1,200 square meters of floor. So a lot of area required for switching a little bit of data between left and right. And it's quite fascinating what kind of monsters and what massive amount of technology they had to develop and deploy. So these kind of switches, the maximum capacity was 16K connections. Some of those connections were used internally and to interconnect the switches. So subscribers, you could connect around 10 to 11,000 subscriber lines to such a switch. the memory capacity, like the hardware maximum memory capacity was 1 megabyte, which is, I think, an absurd amount of memory for, this was deployed in 1975. Yeah, that and according to the documents I have, all of them were deployed with the maximum memory capacity on day one. So they deployed these switches with 1 megabyte of core memory. I'm talking about magnetic core memory, not random access memory or something like that. So like individual magnetic cores, 1 megabyte for each of those switches. They were, the core setup rate was about 30 per second. So since the software doing all the switching and so on consumed a quite significant amount of time, and you only had two up to two processes, each of them possibly redundant, to perform the call setup handling. You could have a maximum of, if you have two of them, a maximum of 60 new call setups per second in the entire switch. I guess that's probably why they charge the 5 cents for each call setup, to make sure they don't overload this by people basically making a call setup for every 50 bytes they're sending. The power consumption is massive. So we're talking about 80 kilowatts at 60 volt DC. That's the normal DC voltage supply in German telephone exchanges, plus another 15 kilowatts of 220 volt back then AC power supply. That AC was for the peripherals, meaning the hard disks and terminals and so on that were associated with the actual switch, which was powered by DC. Plus then the air conditioning to get those 100 kilowatts of electrical or then thermal energy out of the building again. The net floor space of the racks and the equipment is 200 square meters. And as I said, with all the additional stuff you need around it, about 1,200 square meters. Unbelievable scale for shifting a few bits from left to right from today's perspective. So this was the chapter about the Datex L network. Now we're talking about EDS, the switch behind it, the switching technology behind it. I didn't study that in as much detail. I have tons of information. It's a question of finding the time to really understand it down to that level of detail. But I think it's, so I'll just present an overview here. At some point in the 60s, they means the telephone administration, recognized the need for higher bitrate, higher than 50 bps telex, a wide area data transmission, and conceptual development was started in 1965 to develop this digital switch for the public data network by Deutsche Bundespost. The development was done in cooperation by Siemens and Standard Electronic Lorenz, two German equipment manufacturers. And the first production deployment was in Heidelberg in 1975. And by 1978, they had migrated all of 60% of all their pre-existing Telex and Datex subscribers from the electromechanical switches over to this new EDS-based exchanges. And it was decommissioned in 96 when ISDN was everywhere. And you could basically emulate all of these services provided by. So even if you had legacy equipment that was attaching to the Datex L network, you could just emulate all of this over ISDN. So there was no need for a separate data network anymore. Note also ISDN, the integrated services data network. It integrates telephony and the data network. So the IDN was overtaken by ISDN. This is the logical structure of the different functional units. I'm not going to go into those details. Basically, you have all these connections that go into code converters and decoders, and they are attached to processing elements. So this PE is the Programmsteuerung, is basically the program controller. You could say the CPU doing that, and you have other elements and memory and so on. This is the logical structure of all the multiplexers in front of it. So you have the actual switch, which is several large racks of equipment, and then you have the multiplexers. I already mentioned in the telecom language or in the Bundespost language, it was this part here, Vermittlung, is the DVSD, that's the actual switch. And then we have all these muxers here. They are like this triangular devices, like this C here or the SE here. Those are two different types of muxes. These are basically the DUST, the Datenumsetzerstelle. So you have something like a telex device or some data device, low speed, going to a subscriber line, going to one of these C-type muxes, which then goes into an SE-type mux up to 64 kilobit, and that then goes into the switch over here. This is how one of the multiplexers looked like. This is Datenumsetzerstelle ZD100. I think it's a C-type, so that's the low bit rate for 50 to 300 bit channels and aggregating that into 64 kilobit channels. So as you can see, a rack mount unit here that goes into a rack. And it aggregates these lines up. I couldn't find any pictures of the other type of multiplexer. I suspect it was looking rather similar. This is a picture of one of the hard disks, the peripherals that came with it. So we're talking about like this kind of washing machine sized equipment with the disk platter stack here, a removable disk platters. This was how software was installed on those devices. So basically, you had there's also diagrams about the development process and the assembler and the linker, which was actually called binder in German. So the binder was used to bind the individual libraries and stuff together. And from punch cards, and then the machine executable program was stored on the platter stack here. The platter stack was inserted into this drive. And from there, the program was then loaded into the RAM of the of the actual switch. The hard disk storage, these units had a separate room. If we go back a couple of slides, there's actually a separate room here, the Plattenspeicherraum, which is a separate room in the floor plan of this entire exchange, because it had even stricter environmental requirements. So you can see here there was sort of a you see it in many science fiction, like an airlock kind of device, like in a space station in science fiction, because of the hard disks here, dust particles had to be avoided, and there was very strict requirements of not having too many dust particles. And also the temperature and humidity range was much more constrained than for all of the other equipment. So there was a separate room with separate filters and air conditioning and so on, just for these hard disk drives they put there, which was seen on this picture. Yeah, and that brings me, Reinhard, yeah, clean room indeed. Yes, it's a clean room. Of some extent, I don't think it's as clean as modern clean rooms when we think of semiconductor manufacturing. We're talking about much larger particles, I think, in this context here. But yes, indeed, a clean room for the hard disk. So yeah, I didn't go into more details here. There's a couple of books I scanned on this technology with more of these black and white pictures. But I mean, it's just racks and racks and racks full of equipment and cables. I didn't want to put all of them in my slide deck, but I can open some of these PDFs and show you some of the pictures if you're interested in the equipment. Yeah, I didn't have a slide about what were people actually using this network for. Maybe that before we go for Q&A. The initial low speed up to 300 bit per second systems were really meant for remote terminals. So you had something like a paper or a glass terminal for remote interaction with a mainframe or some mini computer or something. The higher bitrate systems with 2400 bit per second were used, for example, by the Teletex network, which is another topic that I'd like to speak about at some point. Some ancestor of the telefax. So before we had the facsimile, the telefax transmission, there was a predecessor between telex and the fax, and that was using Datex L as a transmission medium at 2400 bits per second. And the higher bitrate, like 9600 PPS, was mainly used for batch transmission. So some mainframes exchanging batches of data overnight. There also were some examples of, for example, banks using this technology with intelligent terminals. So you had, let's say somebody wanted to apply for a loan for buying a house or something like that. And then if the branch of the bank would have some intelligent terminal with some masks, local masks on the screen, where you enter all the data of the applicant for this loan, including you know, the usual stuff like how much money per month the loan will be repaid with, and the duration of the loan, and the total amount of money, and so on and so on. And then when all the data was entered into those masks locally in the intelligent terminal, you would basically transmit that data to the mainframe to compute the rates and the loan payment plan and so on, to create an offer for the customer. And so quickly, in less than half a second, the circuit switch data connection was established, then some data was exchanged, and the connection was terminated again. And the local masks and the software and the intelligent terminals was updated overnight when the rates were low in the Datex network. So you could do basically software updates overnight of these intelligent terminals. So these are the kind of applications that this network was used. I didn't really find numbers of how many subscribers they had at any given point in time. I mean, they always say, well, we had more than 100,000 subscribers in total, but that includes the telex subscribers, all the legacy teletype stuff. And so I haven't found them broken down to how many of these were actually using anything more than the 50 bit per second that they already had in their previous old analog electromechanically switched networks. Yeah, and with that, I'm going to stop. And yeah, if anyone has questions or comments while the recording is still running, please raise them now. So the question is, could you connect calls between async and sync nodes? No. I mean, technically, yes, but I don't think it would have worked. Also, something that I didn't explicitly mention, but sort of it was implicit, is that your connection had one fixed speed. So since there was different monthly rates and different equipment, so if you had a line for, let's say, 9600 PPS, that was the only supported speed of your line, and you could not interconnect to other subscribers using other speeds. So basically, if you had 9,600 bit per second service, you could only connect to other 9,600 bit per second subscribers and so on. For the async and sync, I don't think so, no. Based on the technology, I think like the call would have been established and you would be billed for it, but no meaningful communication would have been possible between the sync and the async terminal on both sides, as far as I understand the technology.